Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of the recent AP report based on French and Iraqi intelligence sources that claims 400 Daesh or Islamic State fighters have been seeded into the refugee flow in Europe and are now poised to create mayhem. A former radical who was deeply involved in jihadism until he came to see that his extremism was inconsistent with the teaching of the Quran, Mubin Sheikh, joins us. He became an undercover counterterrorism operative for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service and is the author of Undercover Jihadi, Inside the Toronto 18 Al-Qaeda-Inspired Homegrown Terrorism in the West. And we will discuss how, as Daesh is getting pounded in Syria and Iraq and losing territory, it is striking back by employing asymmetrical warfare to attack soft targets in Europe. Then we will speak with Peter Dreyer, the Distinguished Professor of Politics at Occidental College and author of The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. We will discuss his article at The American Prospect and The Huffington Post, Paul Ryan, the GOP's next presidential nominee, and the desperate efforts underway by the Republican establishment to stop Trump as they throw their lot in with a right-wing radical now posing as a centrist, Ted Cruz. And we'll look into whether the increasing speculation about a brokered Republican convention could be an opening for a dark horse to emerge in the form of Paul Ryan riding to rescue the GOP from an electoral meltdown in 2016. Then finally, we'll examine the revolution underway in political fundraising that Bernie Sanders has tapped into, where a grassroots army of small donors is making up for the billionaires arrayed against the Sanders campaign, which has forged a partnership with the nonprofit Act Blue, who this month announced that they had raised more than $1 billion for Democrats since their launch in 2004. David Karpf, a professor in the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University and author of The Move On Effect, The Unexpected Transformation of American Political Advocacy, joins us. And joining us now is Mubin Sheikh, who became radicalized with the Taliban in 1995 and was deeply involved in jihadism until the 9/11 attacks, after which he questions his extremist interpretation of Islam. He then spent 2 more years studying Islam in Syria, where he came to see how his extremism was inconsistent with the teaching of the Quran. And after returning to Canada in 2004, he became an undercover counterterrorism operative for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. And he is the author of Undercover Jihadi, Inside the Toronto 18, Al-Qaeda-Inspired Homegrown Terrorism in the West. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mubin Sheikh.
Thank you for having me.
And Mubin, what do you make of this AP story that came out yesterday saying that up to 400 Daesh self-declared Islamic State fighters had been seeded into the refugee flow into Europe and were poised to create mayhem?
Yeah, the notion of ISIS sending in operatives in the refugee flows was discussed some time ago, at least a year ago. I know because I was watching those conversations unfold. The number of 400 seems to be odd. It's very difficult to know, I mean, that kind of number. But even if 100 were sent over, and if half of those are suicide bombers / terrorism operatives, then, of course, you're looking at a very, very big problem.
And the sources for the AP story were Iraqi and French intelligence services. What's your sense of how reliable this information might be?
Well, you know, I will give it some reliability. I mean, you know, it's already known that individuals have been sent back. This is not contested. But again, the coming from the Iraqis, given the fact that the Iraqis have themselves been not as successful as they would like to be in dealing with Daesh, you know, I guess they're just relaying onto Europe what many in Europe already know, especially among the security services.
Well, the Iraqis are supposedly poised to try and take Mosul, which is the first big city captured by Daesh. And is there a connection there, the fact that Daesh is getting hammered in Iraq and Syria and supposedly losing territory? So have they decided to stay relevant by going after soft targets in Europe?
Well, the attacking of targets in Europe was, you know, was on the top of their list from the very beginning. They're doing, you know, exactly what they said that they would be doing. And yes, as they are degraded more and more, and they are being degraded, you will see more of these attacks.
So what do you make then of the fact that the Turkish authorities went public and pointed out that one of the bombers in Brussels who blew himself up was detained by Turkish authorities, having been in Syria, presumably with Daesh, and they alerted and they put him on a plane to the Netherlands, and they alerted both Dutch and Belgium authorities that this guy was a hardcore jihadi who'd fought with the Islamic State, and yet apparently nothing happened to him.
Yeah, there's a number of problems here. One is when a foreign country is telling you that such and such a person has done X, Y, and Z, if they don't give evidence of said wrongdoing, then that is not going to trigger that significant of a surveillance response. Number two, the number of people that are required to conduct surveillance is, I mean, at least you're looking at 20 people for one person. And if we allocated, you know, surveillance to every person who is quote unquote on a watch list, they just don't have, you know, that amount of people to do it. So, and the third problem is, of course, intelligence sharing. In Belgium in particular, there are many local police forces, you know, all of whom have difficulties communicating with each other. And they really have an institutional problem that is really going to see an overhaul in the coming months.
But here in the United States, there's a law that if anybody was involved with a terrorist organization, if they returned to the United States, they would immediately be arrested for giving material support to terrorists. And in fact, this law is such a blanket law that if you donated $5 to some charity that happened to be giving money to Daesh, you could spend a lot of time in jail. What similar laws exist in Europe or Canada, for that matter?
Yeah, the issue of material support charges, again, in a Western legal framework, if you don't have evidence of that criminal wrongdoing, those charges are not going to hold up in court. So this is the problem. I mean, in Canada, we're faced with a similar dilemma. We have individuals who have returned back from Iraq and or Syria, and we have no evidence to charge them. And let's explore this a bit further. I mean, think about how you would get that evidence. You would need somebody undercover in ISIS, and ask yourselves what that person may have to do to keep their cover in ISIS. So now if in a Western court, you then bring somebody who you inserted as an undercover, who may be raped, murdered, tortured, used chemical weapons, how credible is their testimony going to be in providing evidence of wrongdoing? This is the big dilemma.
Yeah, but you don't go to Raqqa for tourism, do you? I mean, these people were caught coming out of Syria at the Turkish border, and apparently Turkish intelligence has in many ways facilitated the flow coming in, the MIT, and now, of course, they've changed their tune. So presumably there's quite a bit of information. And wasn't there a huge data release of all the names of all the foreign terrorists who've come and gone into Daesh?
Yes, right. So the first problem is even if the intelligence services know that somebody has gone over, what's your proof that it was them in that place? Now, again, I mean, an undercover is the only one that can verify that, or a list. And this is exactly what we saw. I mean, what I do know in speaking with the German federal police is the Syrian opposition obtained a list of many nationalities and have given that list to individual countries. So, for example, Germany was given a list of Germans. And on that list was, of course, names. In some cases, there were passport details. This is stuff that, of course, they're not going to release to the public in terms of, you know, let's say, you know, Canada is not going to say we got records of Canadian passports. But I'm saying generally, the intelligence services now have a lot more information that does, in fact, verify where a certain person has been and what they've been doing. So in that regard, what many of intelligence agencies are noticing is that, one, it verifies lists that they have of people they suspected had gone over, and number two, gives them a list of people that they now need to look at. So you will see arrests taking place. You will see more raids occurring in these countries that these individuals came from.
And again, I'm speaking with Mubin Sheikh, who became radicalized with the Taliban in 1995 and was deeply involved in jihadism until the 9/11 attacks, after which he questioned his extremist interpretation of Islam. He then spent two more years studying Islam in Syria, where he came to see how his extremism was inconsistent with the teachings of the Quran. And after returning to Canada in 2004, he became an undercover counterterrorism operative for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service and was one of the few people in the world to have been undercover in Al-Qaeda-inspired domestic terror groups. And he testified in multiple legal hearings, resulting in the prosecution and conviction of 11 aspiring terrorists. And he's the author of Undercover Jihadi, Inside the Toronto 18, Al-Qaeda-inspired homegrown terrorism in the West. So apparently this fellow, Salah Abdeslam, who was involved in the attacks in Paris and was the most wanted fugitive and was recently caught, and he was largely caught because they went to an apartment where they had a shootout with an Algerian fellow that they shot, but two guys escaped, and that's in that apartment they found all this bomb-making equipment, ISIS flags, and Salah Abdeslam's fingerprints. And there's a theory that these attacks were moved up because they thought he was going to squeal on them, because he was, after all, the guy that didn't blow himself up in the Paris attacks. But my understanding is that German intelligence authorities had said that Salah Abdeslam went to Hungary to meet with some people that had come in the refugee flows, and that perhaps he met with a Daesh handler. He went to Germany under a different name. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, so the first point is the network is definitely connected. I mean, Abdeslam and Abaoud was one of the Paris attackers and who died in a shootout that day. They were friends. They spent time in prison together. So there's very good reason to believe the network is connected. Number two, the traveling to Hungary and these other countries, I don't know the details of that. What we do know is, look, these guys would have had a command and control system in place in Europe. This is something that's being set up for the past year. And, I mean, again, I don't know if his travels to Hungary, but we know of their activities in Belgium. I mean, the fact that he was hiding in plain sight actually tells you that he went to a place that was comfortable for him, while everyone else was thinking he may have gone back to Syria, he may have gone here and there. One of the best tactics is to just hide in plain sight. Three, given the fact that in the raid, they recovered cell phones, they recovered SIM cards, and yes, they probably looked at what was being said in the media about Abdeslam cooperating. This definitely would have made them expedite their attacks.
So the fact that he went to prison, Salah Abdeslam, and my understanding is from his neighbors and his family have told reporters and police investigators that he was a different person. He was a petty criminal. He ran a bar with his brother, and his brother blew himself up in the Paris attacks. They were selling dope at this bar, etc., and playing ISIS videos and stuff. But when he came out of prison, supposedly he was a different person. There's a phenomenon that's often been referred to as Prislam, where people get radicalized in prison. Is that an element here? I mean, there seems to be a consistency throughout many of these attackers, going back to Charlie Hebdo in Paris, that they are petty criminals who don't seem to have any particular political awareness and certainly no political sophistication.
Yeah, I think this validates the whole argument that these individuals who are joining these groups and doing these things, the ideology, the religion, is a costume to them. It's the criminality that comes first. And with that criminality is, you know, the comfortability to use violence, the being used to being around people who use violence, your moral decision making capabilities are degraded. You know, you're more like, if you're going to rob somebody, if you're going to hurt, you know, physically attack somebody, that's the progression towards committing greater acts of violence. Number two, for a lot of these people who are thugs, drug dealers, fraudsters, when they do get into prison, what happens is, the extremist ideology gives them a way out. It says to them, listen, you were, you know, your violence that you were doing, it was all illegitimate. But we can legitimize your skills. We can utilize your skills. Here's a religious cause that you can associate yourself to, and you can now leave this world with a quote-unquote clean slate because you've done this. You've now committed an act of violence that's been made sacred.
So is that why then Daesh and the self-declared Islamic State make no secret of jihadi brides, and that you can come and rape and pillage and join us, and you know, you can have all the jihadi brides that you can handle? Is that why they kind of, they both advertise their so-called religiosity on the one hand, but they also advertise the fact that you can rape and pillage and plunder?
Yeah, this, I mean, we see this. We see other individuals accused of sexual assault charges, especially people from the UK. And again, it puts a veneer of religiosity over criminal acts. So it makes the person not, you know, feel not as bad doing what they ultimately know is bad doing. But they try to convince themselves that, no, it's not as bad because we're doing it in the name of the religion. And this is the problem. Like, these are criminals who Islam is not their faith. It's their costume.
So in terms of the criticisms that are being leveled against the Belgium authorities, some of it does seem to be fairly legitimate, in as much as there was a group called Sharia for Belgium operating very much in the open, starting just after 9/11, where it would commemorate 9/11 every year with big celebrations in Antwerp, and they spread throughout the country. And then the recruiter who recruited Salah Abdeslam apparently was well known in the neighborhood, and many of the mothers of the kids that went off to Syria and didn't come back have identified this person and are angry at them. But it was only last February that they closed down the Sharia for Belgium group. So is that what Tony Blair was referring to when he talked about there's too much flabby liberalism in Europe?
Yes. I mean, it is, I can't understand. It is beyond me how you can let groups like this who openly glorify terrorism to continue doing what they're doing. It defies belief. You know, when we talk about freedom of speech, we're talking about speech that is constructive to society. We're talking about, you know, political opposition groups who, even whatever, regardless their political views, they're still moving towards some kind of positive contribution to society. Now, when you have individuals glorifying terrorism, celebrating terrorism, I mean, why then are we surprised that they're recruiting people, they're sending people over, those people are coming back, plotting attacks, the guys who have not yet left are plotting attacks? So this is a question that really countries need to ask themselves, is you really do need to draw a line somewhere. And I'm pretty sure it's a safe bet to say that glorification of terrorism, encouraging, advocating terrorism, this is flabby on our part, absolutely.
So you would make an association between the fact that Belgium has the highest number of jihadis that have gone to fight for Daesh per capita of any other European country. At least 560 have gone, and up to 150 have returned.
Well, absolutely. I mean, they have the highest per capita, and look what you're seeing now. You know, France and Germany are followed closely, and look what we see happening in France. I mean, Germany has been spared for the most part, but we don't know how long that's going to last.
Well, just in closing, Mubin Sheikh, obviously we've had Islamophobic responses here from Donald Trump and from Ted Cruz, who wants to have police patrols in Muslim neighborhoods here in the United States, even though there aren't any really any Muslim neighborhoods to speak of, because people from Muslim countries come to the United States and they integrate successfully. They don't live in ghettos, which is apparently a part of the problem in Europe. So obviously the enlightened approach would be to get these communities within Europe to cooperate and find ways to isolate these radicals, as opposed to tainting everybody with the same brush by these Islamophobic kind of political grandstanding that we're seeing here in the United States from Donald Trump and Ted Cruz.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Islamophobia and, you know, Islamic hatred, you know, Islamist supremacism, they exist in a symbiotic union. You know, at the end of the day, what we need to prevent is isolating and marginalizing, you know, generalizing a whole community. This is not going to help us. It is only detrimental to us, and we need to move away from that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Mubin Sheikh.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mubin Sheikh, who became radicalized with the Taliban in 1995 and was deeply involved in jihadism until the 9/11 attacks, after which he questioned his extremist interpretation of Islam. He then spent 2 more years studying Islam in Syria, where he came to see how his extremism was inconsistent with the teaching of the Quran. And after returning to Canada in 2004, he became an undercover counterterrorism operative for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. He's one of the few people in the world to have been undercover in an Al-Qaeda-inspired domestic terror group, and Mubin has testified in a number of hearings resulting in the prosecution and conviction of 11 aspiring terrorists, and he's the author of Undercover Jihadi, Inside the Toronto 18, Al-Qaeda-inspired homegrown terrorism in the West. We're going to take a brief station break back, looking into whether Paul Ryan could be the Republicans' dark horse and end up running for the presidency. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Peter Dreyer, who's the Distinguished Professor of Politics and Chair of the Urban and Environmental Policy Department at Occidental College. His books include The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, A Social Justice Hall of Fame, and he has an article at the American Prospect and the Huffington Post, Paul Ryan, the GOP's Next Presidential Nominee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Dreyer.
Thank you, Ian.
So at the moment, it does seem that the so-called establishment, the GOP establishment, although we're not quite sure what that is in a state of panic. They're casting around quite openly for an alternative to Donald Trump. And curiously enough, a right-wing radical is now sort of being kind of sold as a centrist. I'm talking about Ted Cruz. That perhaps is the level of their desperation. One of the candidates who ran, Lindsey Graham, described the choice between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz as the choice between being shot or being poisoned. So far, it's not a very happy year for the Republicans.
You know, the Republican Party is imploding in front of us, and it's kind of like the end of the British Empire. You know, you sort of don't know what's happening until it's over. And it's absolutely true, as you said, that the Republican establishment, you know, Fox News, the major funders, some of the governors and other leaders of the party are desperate to not have Donald Trump as their nominee, not only because they think he can't win the election over either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, but also because he'll jeopardize the election of lots of Republicans down ballot running for Senate and House and governor's races and even maybe school boards and city councils. And so they're fishing around for somebody else. And as Mitt Romney said the other day, you know, I'm not a big fan of Ted Cruz, but he's not Donald Trump. And so he's going to endorse Ted Cruz. And it is only in the wacky world of Republican politics could anybody consider Ted Cruz to be a reasonable centrist. So that's how desperate they've gotten. But as I say in my article in the American Prospect and in Huffington Post, Paul Ryan is waiting in the wings, just as he did when John Boehner resigned from being Speaker of the House. And he claimed that he wasn't interested, but then he accepted being drafted after playing hard to get. And I think this is what Ryan is doing right now. He's playing hard to get. He's pretending he's not interested, but he's doing everything to position himself to be the savior of the party when they get so desperate that they don't want to nominate Donald Trump. But there are too many people that just can't stand Ted Cruz, and so it's really unlikely, as I say in my article, that Cruz will be able to, on the second or third ballot, get enough votes to get 50% of the delegates. And then they'll be hunting around for somebody else. Kasich is hoping he'll be that person, but that's unlikely too. And I'm predicting that it'll be Paul Ryan.
So is it possible that given the down-ballot disaster that both Trump and Cruz would be for the Republicans, that the very people who are in jeopardy, that's the House, the entire House on the Republican side, along with 24 Republican senators, who would they turn to? I mean, maybe wouldn't they be the kind of people that would be talking to Paul Ryan and saying, you know, you got to do something? Because who else is left in the establishment?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they are definitely talking to Paul Ryan. And then 2 weeks ago, a major Republican funder named Earl Mack, who's a businessman, former Bush's ambassador to Finland, he started a PAC called the Committee to Draft Speaker Ryan. And they set up a website, and they had hoped to get a million people to sign a petition. And that looked a little too ambitious for Ryan, and so he asked them to shut it down. And I talked to one of the people who was supposed to be on the staff of that organization, a political operative from New York, and she said, yes, Ryan asked us to shut it down, but that doesn't mean he's not still interested in being drafted. He just didn't want to look that ambitious in public.
So the clues that you cite in your article, Peter Dreyer, are pretty manifest, right? Ryan has come out against Trump over David Duke and the KKK, and he's made it pretty clear that Trump's call to ban Muslims was something that went against American values. He made Ryan made his position very clear on that. He's also been the one that has predicted that the GOP will face a brokered convention. But the key, as you point out, and this was in a pretty interesting speech that Ryan made yesterday on Wednesday, in a speech to the congressional interns where he didn't name Trump specifically, but he talked to the young interns that politics should be a battle of ideas, not a battle of insults. And then the thing that I found extraordinary was that Ryan himself apologized for labeling poor people as the takers, as he did in the famous makers versus takers campaign, which Mitt Romney essentially started with his, saying that 46% of Americans were takers and the rest of them were us Republicans are makers. I thought his apology was sincere. I mean, you can make the case, of course, that it's hypocritical because Ryan has not changed his policies. He still wants to kill off all the anti-poverty programs. So he clearly doesn't care about the poor, but he doesn't think it's right to label them as takers.
You know, I think that's all maneuvering. I mean, Ryan's been relatively invisible since he was elected speaker last October. You know, he has a job to do, and he does it. But he hasn't been out there publicly being the leader of the party in many ways. And in the last 2 weeks, all of a sudden, he's emerged. He's in the news media a lot. He's giving speeches. He's criticizing Trump. It's clear that he's positioning himself for something. He's supposed to chair the Republican convention, but that's just a ceremonial thing. I think he actually wants to be up on stage doing more than chairing the convention. He wants to be nominated for president. And so I think the comment he made, clearly he's attacking Trump. Clearly he's trying to be a spokesperson for the party. He's stepping up to the plate, so to speak. And then that remark he made apologizing for his criticism, his attack on poor people, whether it's sincere or not really doesn't matter, because what matters is whether he's going to revoke these draconian policies that he's been proposing in his budgets for the last couple of years when he was chair of the budget committee and now as speaker, which basically slashes the social safety net for the poor. And so the apology is meaningless. It's simply, to me, it looks like just an attempt to be more appealing to non-Trump voters, to people that want the Republican Party to look like it's at least somewhat compassionate. It's his version of compassionate conservatism. But nothing in his history, nothing in his legislative record, nothing in the budget proposals that he has put forward as chair of the budget committee or when he was running for vice president suggests any trace that he's anything other than an incredible reactionary who's trying to do, to do something with a magic wand, which is to turn himself into an appealing centrist so he can be the broker, the honest broker within the party that brings the party together. And the truth is, I think he can pull it off because he's good looking, he's smart, he's articulate. The fact that he's a Ayn Rand advocate and a libertarian and, as I said, quite reactionary, somehow that's not going to matter if the media doesn't pay attention to his policies and simply plays the horse game, the horse race game, and looks at whether he can win. And I think of all the Republicans in the country right now who could beat Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, I think Paul Ryan is the most likely one to beat them. And so as a Democrat and as a progressive, I'm not looking forward to Paul Ryan being the nominee, but it's what makes the most sense for the Republicans if they want to win.
And again, I'm speaking with Peter Dreyer, who's a distinguished professor of politics and chair of the Urban and Environmental Policy Department at Occidental College. He's the author of The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame. And he has an article at The American Prospect and The Huffington Post, Paul Ryan, the GOP's next presidential nominee. So there's no question that that he has got a reputation amongst the press as a policy wonk and an intellectual, which sort of in many ways disguises the reality that he is a hardcore conservative, if not reactionary ideologue, because most of his budget proposals simply boil down to the fact that he wants to give in more tax cuts to the billionaires, which is absolutely breathtaking. And indeed, when he was negotiating to become the speaker and being coy and being reluctant, one of the conditions was that he needed to go home every weekend to see his kids and spend more time with his family. And this is the man, of course, who's constantly opposing paid family leave. So for regular mortals, while he himself wants that privilege. So I've always been astounded at what a free pass this guy's gotten with the media. And presumably he'll be celebrated as the savior, the man on a white horse coming, in this chaos of Cleveland. He will come through and save the day, and he'd probably be even more lauded.
Yeah, I mean, in my article, I point out all the ways in which the media, most of the media, the mainstream media, have ignored his policy ideas. And when he was putting his budget proposals forward, people thought that he was some policy wonk. But when the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities looked carefully at his budget, the numbers simply didn't add up. And I saw a couple of interviews with him during the 2012 presidential race when he was running as Mitt Romney's running mate as vice presidential candidate. And a few reporters asked him a kind of softball question. Well, some people are saying your numbers don't add up. What do you say? And he didn't actually even have a good answer for even that softball question. He clearly is not the smart policy wonk that people think he is. But, as we're seeing with Donald Trump, what you stand for doesn't matter as long as you're appealing, apparently. and he'll have you know, he'll have a much better public face than Cruz or Trump. And so, you know, the dynamics of all this is that you know, if Trump doesn't go to the convention in Cleveland with 50% of the votes of the delegates, then it's a brokered convention, and then all bets are off, and then they could go to the second or third or fourth or fifth ballot and keep voting until they can find somebody so they get 50%. And so I would predict that it would go to the second or third ballot. Cruz would try to, you know, round up enough votes. He won't be able to do it. Kasich will try to do it. He won't be able to do it. And then, you know, the Republican leaders are going to have to say, well, now what do we do? And if they go for Ryan, which is what I think what they will do, then the question is, then what will Trump do? And if Trump runs a third-party campaign, then there are two possibilities. One is he takes enough votes away from Ryan that Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders win with a landslide. The second possibility is that he takes enough votes away from both the Trump takes enough votes away from Ryan that nobody gets a majority, that, and then it goes to the House of Representatives, which it's done twice in our history before, and they will elect Paul Ryan to be the president. And so, you know, he's got two bites at the apple,
right?
You know, and I think he's not stupid, and he would figure that out, and he'd say, "This could be my year."
Well, this is certainly going to be the year, as you point out in your article, David Dreyer, the year that's similar to 1948, in as much as that was the last time that there was a brokered Republican convention. It took three ballots to get Thomas Dewey to win the nomination. But it was also a crazy presidential election year for both sides. You had President Harry Truman, who'd inherited the presidency from FDR's death. You had New York Governor Thomas Dewey. And then you also, on the Democratic side, you had a third-party run of Vice President Henry Wallace running on the Progressive Party ticket. And then you had the Dixiecrat Governor Strom Thurmond running as a segregationist as well. The analogies to that would be pretty much what you just described, right?
This could be crazy. I mean, I can see the possibility of this going into the House of Representatives, and if Paul Ryan runs and Donald Trump says you've stolen the Republican nomination away from me, there are lots of Republicans and some independents that follow Donald Trump who would want to start a third party, and whether Trump has the persistence to do that, whether he certainly has the ego to want to do that, nobody knows. But, you know, this could be the end of the Republican Party, because a lot of the supporters of Trump will leave. And so, you know, we've never been in a situation quite this dramatic and this complicated since the Civil War, actually, in some ways, where, you know, a new party is going to emerge out of the dust of the implosion of one of the two major parties. And so, you know, all bets are off on what's going to happen, but it's pretty clear to me that it's still possible for Trump to get 50% of the delegates. He can still, if he wins California and a couple of other states, he could do it. But under the with the possibility that he won't go to Cleveland with 50% of the delegates, then this could be a mess. And you know, some of us would be happy to see the Republican Party implode. But, you know, I'm playing like a chess player. I'm thinking down the road, what does that mean? It could mean that Hillary or Bernie get 40% and that Donald Trump gets 30% and that Paul Ryan gets 30%. So nobody gets 270 electoral votes. And then it goes to the House of Representatives. And since the House of Representatives is Republican, they could be nominating electing the new president of the United States, Paul Ryan. And that would be, in some ways, even more undemocratic or equally undemocratic to when the Supreme Court picked George Bush to be the president.
Right. So not only will we have a dysfunctional Supreme Court, we'll have a dysfunctional House. Senate, and White House. What a prospect. I thank you for joining us, Peter Dreyer.
Sure, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Dreyer, who's a distinguished professor of politics and chair of the Urban and Environmental Policy Department at Occidental College. He is the author of The 100 Greatest Americans of the 20th Century, a Social Justice Hall of Fame, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, Paul Ryan, the GOP's next presidential nominee, question mark. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking inside Bernie Sanders' fundraising revolution. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Karpf, who is a professor in the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. His work focuses on strategic communication practices of political associations in America, with a particular interest in Internet-related strategies. He's the author of The Move-On Effect, The Unexpected Transformation of American Political Advocacy. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Karpf.
Thank you for having me.
And it seems that there's a kind of revolution underway in political fundraising in this election season that Bernie Sanders has tapped into, where he sort of formed a kind of grassroots army of small donors to make up for the fact that the billionaires are arrayed against him, and he's certainly no friend of the billionaires.
I hear he's raising about $27 per person. I've heard that number thrown around.
Well, but he's formed a partnership with the nonprofit Act Blue, and they just announced a month ago that they've raised more than $1 billion for Democrats since they started in 2004, and I believe most of that's been in the last couple of years. So what's the nature of that arrangement? Do you know?
That's right. I think partnership is probably too strong of a word. ActBlue is a portal that can be used by any Democratic candidate in order to raise money. So Hillary Clinton could also use ActBlue quite easily. I assume the reason that she's not is just because her organization decided to go with some other fundraising provider. But that's not an exclusive arrangement.
And what is the advantage of ActBlue, and why are so many people giving money to Sanders via ActBlue?
ActBlue has a couple of things going in its advantage. One is that since it's a nonprofit organization, it's taking a smaller bite out of any fundraising than would be found from a competitor organization. Another, and this dates back to what has made ActBlue so potent over the years, is that ActBlue is set up so that anyone can create a fundraising page on their site, and it's got simple tools, widgets, that can be then be installed onto other websites to help with fundraising. So if we go back in the history of ActBlue to, say, 2004, 2006, 2008, what made it particularly potent was that online communities of interest, organizations like the Daily Coast blogging community, could decide which candidates they wanted to support and endorse. And then they could set up fundraising pages through ActBlue and reach out to all their supporters, their community, to raise money for those candidates. That utility that ActBlue provides makes it easy for communities of progressive activists to identify candidates that they want to support and then raise money to make that support really mean something.
But it seems that what Sanders has got going for him is that his supporters chip in little bits of money, you know, every other week or so, and continue to do so. And, of course, I guess there are solicitations that go out on a regular basis. But that seems to be a new phenomenon. that people want, you know, who don't have a lot of money. And I don't believe most of these people have actually given money to a political campaign before.
Yeah, so it's a somewhat new phenomenon. I think what's new is the scale at which it's occurring. But this is actually a phenomenon that we could see in the Obama campaign in 2008, and we could even see in the Howard Dean campaign in 2004. And the crucial element here is, by building this large list of supporters, the Bernie Sanders campaign can then reach out to them and fine-tune their message through a technique that's called A-B testing, where they can send variant messages to different randomly selected segments of their list to find out what sorts of appeals are best designed to reach people where they are right now. And so they can use this testing, because they have such a massive list, in order to figure out what's the right messaging that's going to raise money and build commitment right now. So that's something that actually the Bernie Sanders campaign, I think, would be able to do whether they were working with AtBlue or with another service provider. It's a function of the size of his list and the eagerness of his supporter base, as opposed to a function of the service provider he's working with.
And again, I'm speaking with David Karff, who's a professor in the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University, whose work focuses on strategic communication practices of political associations in America, with a particular interest in internet-related strategies. He's the author of The Move-On Effect, The Unexpected Transformation of American Political Advocacy. So Sanders presumably is not working exclusively through ActBlue. Does he have his own operation that people can also tap into?
Well, ActBlue is the venue through which he raises the money, but he's got this massive list of supporters that he can email, and that's through some other set of technologies.
I see. But the long or the short of it is, it seems that both with Obama in 2008 and now with Sanders in 2016, it looks as though the Democrats have stolen the march on the Republicans in terms of small donors.
Yes. Yeah, I would say, dating back even to 2004, what we've seen is a competitive advantage for the Democrats in small donor fundraising. The unfortunate part of this history is that, as it turns out, at the same moment in American history when small donors through technology were able to finally come together and compete with the large donors, we also had the Supreme Court case Citizens United, which gave large donors unprecedented power to give unlimited money. So at the same moment when we maybe would have gotten parity between the small donors and the large donors, we also unleashed the large donors, which is what we're dealing with right now.
But it does seem that Sanders is doing well enough to keep going, doesn't he? I understand he's probably got more money in the bank than even Hillary has.
He's got quite a bit of money, which means he's going to be able to keep campaigning. The question is whether that's going to turn into delegates, which will turn into an actual presidential nomination, or if it doesn't, what his movement will then turn into.
Right, but it is at least to some extent leveling the playing field, because without this, and with the advantage that the Koch brothers and Adelson and company have on the right, it would be a non-competition, right?
Yeah, that's right. If we didn't have the small donor fundraising that we have right now, then post Citizens United, the large donors would be the only game in town. That's right.
So I had yesterday did an interview with Bill Zimmerman, who is one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants, and he was a strategic communications consultant to MoveOn.org. And he mentioned that the tremendous list that MoveOn.org generated on behalf of Barack Obama, in effect, once Obama became president, that list and that movement just sort of atrophied, and they sort of became less relevant. And he made the point that Bernie Sanders has an even bigger list that he's generated, and that he's more likely to sustain a political movement after this election, whether or not he makes the nomination or not. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense, while also, I think, being quite a bit too harsh. The thing that we need to keep in mind, again, I think we should keep 2004 in view. After the Howard Dean campaign, Dean's List became a political organization, Democracy for America, which has been a fairly effective Netroots political organization that has supported candidates, raised money for candidates, and helped activists to advance a progressive agenda. With the Obama campaign, he had a much larger list, And while that list did become an organization, Organizing for America, that organization was, I think, boxed in an interesting way. And the problem for that organization is, since their candidate won, there was this active question of, what does it mean to be, are you Organizing for America or are you the Democratic Party? The Organizing for America was housed in the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. And there was this real question, when they take actions, since their candidate is in office, are they acting as the party or as an outside group? I think that if we compare the Bernie Sanders list to the Dean list, I think absolutely there's tremendous opportunity here for that list to become a real movement that pressures government from the outside, if that's assuming that Bernie Sanders doesn't somehow pull off a victory and become the nominee. But as an outsider, there will be an opportunity to turn that list into a real movement. I think the critique of the Obama list, that once he entered office, it became very difficult to turn that movement into something that could keep pressuring government when it had supported somebody who now was the government, I think that's overly harsh.
Well, but surely he could have kept that list or kept those people as a lobby, if you will, to pressure Congress. I mean, we've had nothing but gridlock. He did have the House and the Senate and the White House for the first 2 years, mm-hmm. which was exactly what happened with Clinton, by the way, from 92 to 94. But once he lost the House and Senate, it's been nothing but gridlock. Would a list like that be useful for a president to add to the bully pulpit?
It would be, and I would actually argue historically that it was. Ari Melber did a study of the first year of Organizing for America after he had assumed the presidency. I would actually say that he did use that list to pressure Congress. He probably didn't use it aggressively enough. He mostly used it to pressure Republicans to support the Affordable Care Act. I think, you know, if I had my druthers, he also would have used it to pressure conservative Democrats, and he avoided doing that. So there are individual cases, if we want to relitigate back in 2009, the choices they made, there are individual cases where I think they could have been more aggressive. But absolutely, back in 2009, they were activating that list and asking people to go and engage with Congress around the president's priorities. And the challenge there was, since they were promoting the president's existing priorities, it's just difficult to generate as much enthusiasm and activity around, let's support this piece of very complicated legislation, than it is around the goal of, let's elect a president who can lead us. And so we did see a fall off in engagement, but that doesn't mean that they weren't trying to work back in 2009.
Well, it seems to me obviously this is effective, this grassroots fundraising that Bernie Sanders seems to be the main beneficiary of, although Hillary Clinton is sort of playing catch up in terms of trying to get grassroots donations. The thing that I think is appealing about it, I think it's in the best of American political tradition, in the sense it's completely transparent. And I think the fact that people that don't normally give money are giving money is a change, because for the longest time, if you give money to any political party, all you ever get is solicitations in the mail. And, of course, a lot of people don't have a lot of money. So it's very impressive that people are giving money. And I think you can fairly contrast that with these dark money PACs, 501c4s, that don't have to name who their donors are. And these are the ones that the Koch brothers and a lot of these billionaires seem to prefer, that have been organized by Karl Rove. So as bad as the situation is since post-Citizens United, it does seem to me that at least there's some hope on the horizon that we can, you know, level the playing field a little bit.
I think that's right. I think there are reasons for hope. I think that, look, the Sanders campaign has been far more successful than I would have predicted and most people would have predicted. I think if we could take a time machine back 2 years and ask anyone if they thought Bernie Sanders would be doing as well as he is doing right now, they would not say yes. This has been surprising and heartening, the degree to which the Democratic Party base has resonated with this populist message. And I think that the force that's being produced there is a positive for our society and for our democracy. That said, in terms of overturning Citizens United, that's going to come down to the brass tacks matter of who gets elected president and who are they able to support, appoint to the Supreme Court. So this is all going to get decided post-election, really.
Well, unless somehow President Obama is able to get his nominee a hearing and a vote, right? I mean, one assumes that there's a, yes, there's a strategy there.
Unless the Senate actually does its job, yes. But my hopes for the Senate actually holding a vote on this nominee and approving him, just because they have, many of them have gone on record saying that he would be a fine Supreme Court justice, I think that is unfortunately surprisingly unlikely.
Actually, somebody sent me a note today, like a cartoon. It said there are 24 Republican senators up for a vote in 2016. Perhaps they shouldn't be able to vote until the people decide in the elections, turning the argument against them. But just though, in wrapping up this phenomenon here, is it likely to stay on? Because, you know, one of the things that seems to happen is that a lot of movements fizzle out after the Vietnam War, Nixon ended the Vietnam War. That huge movement seemed to sort of fizzle, although arguably there were vestiges of it in politics after that. And more often than not, you know, when politicians go down in flames like Nixon did, they can come back years later, as Reagan did in 76. He came back 4 years later, and so forth. There's a slow burn in American politics in terms of the resurrection of political movements. So do you see this movement carrying on with Sanders, with this fundraising and this list, and the extent to which he's excited an awful lot of people who normally aren't interested in politics and aren't voting? And I guess you can say the same on the other side with Donald Trump. I don't know how he's organizing his supporters, but presumably he's got some kind of database too.
What I would say, particularly about Bernie Sanders, is that I expect this movement to turn into something, and it's going to be something interesting and meaningful. That is actually different than the movement staying on. Because if our expectation of this movement is that a year or two from now, its level of raw activity is going to be higher than it is now, then we're going to be disappointed. Because without a presidential candidate who we need to support this week, this month, there will be lower day-to-day activity. But that doesn't mean that the movement's failing. What we should be judging the movement by is what it turns into, rather than whether its activity levels are going up or down. So, yeah, I expect that this movement will have an impact in American politics moving forward. I think the level of progressive and democratic engagement with economic populism, regardless of who the next president is going to send a strong and important message that reverberates throughout the Democratic Party. But as a single movement, is the movement a year from now going to look day-to-day bigger than it was today? Probably not. And if it doesn't, that doesn't mean that it's failed.
Well, David Carfi, thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Carfi, who's a professor in the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. His work focuses on strategic communication practices of political associations in America, with a particular interest in Internet-related strategies. He's the author of The Move On Effect, The Unexpected Transformation of American Political Advocacy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.